And so let me just say that our Sunday nights, as the elders had asked some months back, a couple of months back now, have been revolving around the thoughts of Don Bassett, Jerry Bassett's brother, of course, whom this congregation knew and loved for an awfully large number of years. Now, both of those men passed away recently. And a book that Don had written entitled The Joseph Code is a fairly detailed study of the life of Joseph. And so we've been going lesson by lesson using each of his chapters as a basis then for the sermon that I'll present on Sunday evenings. And this is the fifth of those in the series. What we've seen, just to start off, is that God must have thought awfully highly of this man, Joseph. There are only 50 chapters in the book of Genesis. That's a fair number of chapters. There's several books much larger. But in 50 chapters, 12 of them are devoted to this man, Joseph. That makes him, what is that, half chapter short of being the central figure in 25% of the book of beginnings. Genesis means beginnings. It is the beginning of many things that we read about throughout this book. But an enormous amount of time then, nearly a quarter, is devoted to this one man from his very young age, apparently 17, until his death. The last quarter of the book of Genesis is devoted to him. And so there's a wealth of material in there. And what I'm going to do at the start is to review just highlights of a total of six events that take place in his life, all of which will reveal and manifest, exemplify a particular quality that's very obvious in the man himself. The title slide that you see here, of course, is from Egypt, over which many long years ago Joseph had for a number of years second in command authority, having rescued first the Egyptians by way of interpreting a dream and then storing up foods for a 7-year famine that was coming. And then, of course, finally rescuing his own people from whom he had been alienated all of this time, when they were able to come during this same famine for relief to the Egyptians. So you'll recall, I think most of you be familiar enough with Joseph's life to know that in Genesis chapter 37, he's first introduced to us. In verses 2 and 3, it says, we'll see at the bottom of the screen, Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic, what we usually refer to as a coat of many colors, which of course will get him in trouble with the jealousy of his brothers. And so Joseph, at the age of 17's troubles will begin. So we're familiar with all of that. But you'll notice here that as we're going to go through this set of six slides, I'm going to be just building line by line what I take to be, I'm agreeing with Don here, and even added a couple to what he had suggested, that what Joseph is doing is being a faithful servant. With this first one, you can see I've put a question mark after it as father's faithful servant. Because you've just read the text, and it's not clear, it's not that it's separated out in a dramatic statement made, but it looks to me like that when he brings this bad report back to his father at the age of 17, judging by what follows in the rest of his life, I don't think he's just sniping at his brothers. I don't think, as so many people do, you know, that he's just picking on them or currying favor with his father. I realize that it says Israel loved Joseph more, that's Jacob, another name for Jacob, loved Joseph more than all of his sons because he was the son of his old age. But I highly doubt that that's the only reason. He's not just loving this son because he had waited so long for him, son of his old age, son of his first, or at least favorite, wife. You know, I think the two are put together, and I hope you'll see at least a hint there, as I do, that it's at least a possibility that what these verses are in the scriptures to teach us is that even as the son is loved by his father, The son is faithful to his father. He loves his father as much as his father loves him. So he is going to have to get crossways, you know, with 11 brothers to bring back this bad report. And at 17, he's not a fool. And virtually anybody at that age would realize that if you're going to go and rat out, you know, all these brothers, maybe one or two of them aren't going to care for this much. So we don't know what the event is. We don't know how harshly the father responds or maybe punishes the other sons. We don't know the grief that they suffer because of it. But first comes this report. Then comes him being singled out with the coat. And I'm suspecting that there's an awful lot between the lines that's taking place there, in that Jacob, Israel, is recognizing a faithful son who's taken his side rather than even his brother's sides, to be able to say, you know, look, they're not doing right here, and you should know about that, even if it's going to be costly to me. So we'll put a question mark after that one. But from that point on, it's very apparent that Joseph knows how to be a faithful servant. When it comes to his now being sold into captivity, he winds up in the household of Potiphar. Says in chapter 39, now verses 5 and 6, it came about that from that time he, Potiphar, made him, Joseph, overseer in his house and over all that he owned. You don't do that unless you see reason to trust the individual that you're doing such a thing with. And that trust, we are told, is because in preceding verses, God is blessing everything that Joseph does. God is not usually in the business of blessing everything that unfaithful, selfish, greedy, misbehaving people do. That happens. It is true that you can lead a terrible life and still see much of the prosperity that the world can offer. But in those preceding verses, now I think we're seeing the conclusion, Joseph knows how to be a faithful servant. So he's made overseer in the house over all that Potiphar owned, and the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. So again, we're told now in verse 5, after four verses suggesting that, thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Potiphar just turned the whole estate over, a large one. Didn't even worry about it. Didn't even think about it. He was concerned about retiring, I guess, is what this is. Joseph, take care of it. I'm going to see what's on television and tend to, you know, making sure I get well fed. So, you know, that's kind of lifestyle he's living at the end. It's just taking the fruits of his labors now and enjoying his life. He can trust Joseph because Joseph has proven himself trustworthy. Then, the next verses, 7 through 9, he demonstrates here, and I'm using kind of a different title for it maybe, but he proves himself to be faithful and righteous in this event, not just toward Potiphar, though Potiphar is who he's citing first. Still see in verse 7, it came about after these events, his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. She said, lie with me, but he refused. And he said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. He's put all that he owns in my charge. There's no one greater in this house than I, which suggests how many servants there are and how huge this estate and this operation, these businesses, whatever he's running, are. There's no one greater in this house than I. He's withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? Well, he's being faithful to Potiphar, as he's proven before, but he's certainly being faithful to his God now as well, regardless of the cost that he might anticipate is going to be coming his way. He's been his father's servant. He's been Potiphar's servant. He's been God's servant. He has been absolutely trustworthy in every way. He proves himself morally upright here. He proves himself a good manager prior to that. He proves himself to be a man who knows what it is to be in charge of other people's concerns. and not then to resent the power those others have had over him, not to abuse the powers that they've yielded to him for his own personal gain, but always and only with absolute sincerity serve the other one, submits to that other one's needs and desires and wishes and dreams, you know, even if, thinking in terms of Potiphar now being kind of lazy and, you know, thinking about nothing but food, we can imagine he might not be the most respectable man that Joseph's ever seen. But this learning how to submit, this learning how to care about somebody else, whoever, whatever they may be above all else, is a hard thing to do for most people. You know, most of us, you know, we go to work in the morning. For the first 27 years that I was preaching, I had a full-time job while I was preaching. I had a number of different bosses, some for which I had absolutely no respect whatever, others, you know, at varying levels. But, you know, through all of that, it's really not easy to think first about the boss. I remember being very young and finding out how many people pilfer things from their employers and off the job. And then we'll say, I've had people try to convince me it's a good idea because they felt they deserved more than they were being paid. Well, such people who think that they could pay themselves more with petty thefts, you know, around the job site, are not the kind of folks that will find themselves in charge of a large home like Potiphar's. Not find themselves perhaps so trustworthy as to be left alone, as Joseph was in this circumstance, to face the trial that he just did. This is impressive. This is just most admirable. This man, as he's coming through his young years, knows what it is to be a servant under all circumstances. And for it, he gets thrown into jail. You know the story right well. Here now, in chapter 39, verses 22 and 23, the jailer committed to Joseph's charge. That's getting to be a familiar phrase, Joseph's charge. All the prisoners who were in the jail. So that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. So once again now, God is very carefully in these 12 and a half chapters setting the stage in these early chapters for us to appreciate how God is involved, God is blessing. He is advancing to number one in whatever circumstances he finds himself because God is rewarding him for his faithful servant. Now, in the jail, yeah, I suppose it sounds like now Joseph finds himself in charge of the kitchen and the food. He's apparently in charge of the laundry. He's in charge of the garbage. You know, he's in charge of who knows how many different things. But we're going to have one smoothly running prison here, aren't we? And we got a whole collection of guys, everybody in a jail, you know, has got reason to have chips on their shoulder. I suppose we've got a jail that would be the best jail you ever saw. The one all the bad guys would want to wind up in, you know, if they get caught, which none of them think they will, but eventually most do. And so, you know, here then, this is a jail that's going to have less, I'm imagining, of the fights and all of the stuff, you know, that goes on, assuming these people are not entirely out of their minds. With Joseph in charge, would he be a guy you could go to that could help resolve problems? Is he a guy who's going to listen and see with the power given to him that there's going to be good food? And is he the guy, you know, to take charge of your problems, whatever they may be? Every one of his bosses thinks so. And it takes a tremendously foolish jailer to treat prisoners in a manner that does nothing but provoke more resentment. You're just begging for a riot. You're just asking to have your own life threatened. And if you ever have watched the news, you know, through the last years, all over the world, we have these jail riots all the time. And when we do, the chief jailer does not usually get some sort of trophy for how well he's been managing the facility. What happens to him? He gets either killed in the riot or instantaneously fired. He's a failure. What kind of trust does a jailer have to have in a prisoner to turn the whole facility over to him to run? When it's his head that's on the chopping block two different ways. What kind of a man do you have to be to prove to the jailer that you are worthy of such respect and trust that this facility can be turned over to you? And he does it. It's one thing to watch Joseph make a lot of money, so now I'm going to put myself up in my lazy boy and think about my food. That's Potiphar. But this jailer, this is a man who has to be on red alert all the time. Who's the man that he decides he can go to yellow alert with? It's Joseph. Then comes chapter 41, verses 38 through 40. Whose servant is Joseph now? Now, it takes us some chapters to get there, the interpretation of a dream, and then the actual years of plenty and famine, you know, and all the rest of this is coming, so it'll be proven. But he's going to interpret the dream at this moment, and after he's interpreted this dream and given a wise counsel on how to handle this upcoming famine, then in Genesis 41, 38 through 40, Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit?" For the job, because I didn't have room on the slide, that he's just described in the preceding verses. Joseph says, here's what the dream means. You should appoint somebody wise to start taking, you know, a tax, if you will, a portion for storing up in anticipation of the famine. So Pharaoh says, well, who are we going to find better than this one? He can interpret dreams. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has informed you of all this, there's no one so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house. According to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne will I be greater than you. Well, at this moment, you cannot become more powerful on the planet. There is no wealthier empire. There is no empire with more soldiers. There is no empire with more land. There is no empire on the planet that is as powerful as these people are. And what are they recognizing along the way? The character of a man who serves a most peculiar God who is certainly not theirs. That in itself gets people in trouble. But Joseph has risen through all of these trials to such esteem in the eyes of those who in the normal scheme of things would have no reason to respect him at all. He's an insult to their religion. He's a prisoner. Why do I respect that? And every time, the influence of God in Joseph's life comes out in the eyes of these people. What I think we're learning, what Don is suggesting, you know, is that as we're looking at the life of a man like this, this is a man who, while he was thrown out of the country by his brothers, sold into slavery, worked his way through prison to the position that he's in right here. Did this 17-year-old kid have some kind of grudge about how the God of his fathers back in Israel isn't treating him right? Wouldn't there not have been enormous pressure on Joseph to blame Yahweh, that God so far away that hasn't done anything good for me but turned my brother's hatred against me because I accurately prophesied and honestly reported what they had done? And then, I'm guessing, by the time he got down into that jail cell, this young man would have had a whole lot of reasons to lose his faith, to forsake his God, to turn his back on what he had been learning only up through teenage years. How easy it would have been to throw all of that off. And here now towers not some young teenager. Here is a man's man. Here is a guy who has earned the respect of absolutely everybody that he comes into contact with. That is some kind of a guy. And the last of these six is in chapter 45, verses 5 through 7. Do not be grieved, Joseph says, or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years. There are still 5 years in which there'll be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Well, now, brethren, if God has been speaking with this man on occasions more than the couple that have been mentioned, you know, well, then we just don't know about it. Maybe he has. But I, for one, have to marvel at the understanding that he has right here. And I'm thinking, even if I've been receiving revelations from God, and he has more than one, interpreting these dreams of his own and of Pharaoh, even so, how am I going to feel about my brothers when they come begging now? I know how I would feel. And even if it is God's plan to rescue these people, what would I know for certain sure? They don't deserve it. Wouldn't you feel that way? Wouldn't you just want to say, you got it coming? Wouldn't you really want to say, you should reap what you sowed? We had a whole lesson on that this morning. Wouldn't you be sore tempted to take justice into your own hands? Now, when you read through these chapters, and we've left that to you, we haven't read them in any of these five lessons. We're looking at the highlights there, hoping you'll take some time to do it. You know, you've looked through all this. You understand he did rough them up a little, didn't he? I'll say a little. He made them work for it. He concealed who he was. He was learning, though, through all of that, what kind of people they were, how trustworthy they were. And perhaps in those investigations, he's come to have more respect for them. But in the end, and all I'm giving you is just this, you know, few verses, do you remember the passion with which he received them? The weeping so loud that it could be heard through the walls. The Egyptians fearful for what was going on because he was so overwhelmed with emotion now that his family has come back and understands they should be received back, we're being rescued, it is God's plan. I don't know. Maybe he had, you know, further revelations. But whether he did or not, this is still a triumphant life. Just an amazing life. That he could serve his God, his people, his captors, his jailer, all of them, with such absolute unwavering faithfulness. Now, I've had occasion recently on two other opportunities I've seized to do it. I'm going to do it again tonight. Remember these passages. Mark them down in your Bible. There are two places that are especially prominent in the New Testament. Tell us why we have the book of Genesis and, in fact, the whole 39 books of the Old Testament. Romans 15:4 says, whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. Was there ever a verse that more directly would point back as just chief of all those examples to one person in the Old Testament? If ever such a verse would have one guy that you'd easily recognize fit the bill, it's Joseph, isn't it? Brethren, what was written about Joseph was written for Christians' instruction as well as all the saints of the Old Testament times. It's a story about perseverance. It is one that gives encouragement in those scriptures for the end result of such faithfulness. And in it, indeed, we find hope. Do we not? So when we're told in the Roman letter by an inspired apostle, that entire Old Testament is for you. It'll encourage me. It'll bring hope. It instructs us. It teaches about perseverance. Joseph's just premier. And then in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11 is the second of these two passages. These things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. We've had occasion to talk about the ends of the ages and how the first century people particularly would recognize that. But still yet to this day, there's a New Testament. And so while we didn't live in the ends of the ages that they lived in, we still live in our times in need of Joseph's example and the rest of the Old Testament's instruction. So in Proverbs, poor, in chapter 10, verse 4, is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Proverbs 13, 4, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, and the soul of the diligent is made fat. In 21, verses 25 and 26, the desire of the sluggard puts him to death, for his hands refuse to work. All day long he craves, while the righteous gives and does not hold back. So the poor hadn't anything to give. He's hungry himself. And the righteous are just given freely all the time. What do these three verses say in Proverbs? They say, work hard. Don't be lazy. Follow Joseph's example and not Potiphar's. I'm thinking about food and nothing else. And brother, there's so much more. Proverbs 12:24 says the hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. 22:9 says, do you see a man skilled in his work? He'll stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. No identifying qualifier appears in this passage about what work you're doing. Whether the world thinks it's high and great and wondrous, or just menial, you know, and cheap and something they'd never want to do. Doesn't matter. You see a man skilled in it, whatever it is that he does. And not very often I get to brag. I did a little bit of it this morning. You know, I boast every once in a while. But I will have you know I'm the best dishwasher that Love's Barbecue Pit ever had. And I was told that when I was 16 years old. I had waitresses come to me and say I was the only one who could keep them in clean cutlery on Friday and Saturday nights during the rush hour. And I was a year younger than this man, and I wasn't a Christian. But I took pride in my work. And frankly, being a dishwasher is not a great thing, is it? It was my first ever job, $1.35 an hour. Big money. Back then, 68, if you're wondering. What do these proverbs say? They also give instruction. They also give encouragement. They also, you know, bring hope. So, you want to stand before kings? You don't want to be obscure? Do the best that you possibly can. My cousin had a girlfriend for a while. She was a cook. Does that sound like a big deal? She was the cook for Michael Eisner. Who's he? Head of Walt Disney Productions. She got to go everywhere he went. She prepared his every meal, wherever he was. France, we got a Disneyland. Both coasts, you know. She was his cook. Now, do you think maybe if you do the best you can, I know there's whole shows devoted to chefs now, you know, there's just no telling where you might find yourself. A theme is developing. We're going to look at two verses in the New Testament. We'll bring this to a close. In Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 through 8, it says, slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling in the sincerity of your heart as to Christ, not by way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart with good will, render service as to the Lord, not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. In Colossians 3:22, verses 3:22 through 24, slaves, in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, do your work heartily, as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. Said it several times on occasion of, you know, Joseph and others, but it's been estimated up to 50% of the Roman Empire when these two letters were written were slaves. Now I can tell you for sure they were not all great slave owners, slave holders, and slave masters in the Roman Empire, that brutal time. So these slaves, didn't matter who was the master, how were they to serve? Heartily, good conscience, in every way, seeking the best interest of the other. So here it is, brethren. There's really only two very simple lessons in the life of Joseph in this regard. Do your level best was the term my dad always used, and I never did figure out why he put level in front of it. Have you heard that? Your level best? What does that mean? Is that a carpenter's term? Regardless of any and all circumstances. Starting in Numbers 18 with Bill Kohler's read a little while ago, what were the Jews to give? The best. The very best. When they brought their tithes to their God. You give your best, you be your best, and you do your best. And it doesn't matter what circumstances you find in this life. Number two, things are a good deal more likely to turn out well through faithfulness than through selfishness and sin. Now, aren't they? Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 10, we look to these things for examples. So I'm putting this lesson together. I'm thinking about Don. That always makes me think about Jerry. I'm thinking about these preachers that have done so much and for so long and now gone on, you know, to their reward. I'm thinking about the lessons that they provided. And then, you know, it reminded me of another principle in the earth today. Yeah, I heard somebody whisper it this time. What's it about? That most fundamental of all laws in the universe is what I taught this morning, is this one. You reap what you sow. So, brethren, carry big bags of seed. Big bags. Heavy bags of seed. Carry right up to the seed that would break the camel's back. And then sow it all heartily, as unto the Lord, when injustice reigns over your life, and then know you will reap what you sow. And as the song suggests, while we sing, there's room in God's kingdom for the small things that we do, the moderate things that we do, and the giant things that we do too. If we can help you be a more faithful servant, if you're ready this day to become a Christian, if you need help in prayer or Bible study in some other way, let it be known, please. Come speak with me as we stand, please. Come speak with me as we stand, please.